and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow at Bruegel, joined today by Jason Furman, professor at Harvard and former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under President Barack Obama, and our director, Bruegel's director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer. We are speaking to you in advance of Bruegel's annual meetings coming up in early September. You'll hear more about those. And we are going to try to talk about what is Europe now in this incredibly volatile global situation. We have President Donald Trump in the United States making all kinds of changes to the U.S. and pushing for all sorts of changes in the rest of the world. We have China dealing with its own economic challenges. We have war situations in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Where does Europe fit into all of this? Jason, thank you for joining us. And how do you see Europe at this point?
First of all, I'm thrilled to be doing this conversation with Jeremy, because usually my answer to Europe is whatever I've heard him say recently. But, you know, when I look at Europe, I see a combination of just real disappointment, but also, you know, hope and potential. For 25 years, there's been slower productivity growth than the United States. The gap between the United States and Europe has grown when the opposite should be the case. Normally, you should be catching up. That has been, you know, just as bad in recent years after the pandemic as it was before. And so that's the disappointment. The hope is, you know, just the level of understanding about this in Europe, the level of, you know, discussion around the set of changes that need to be made. Some of the changes that have been made, like Next Gen EU, what's going on with defense buildup, you know, fiscal shifts in Germany, all of that fills me with a certain amount of hope as well.
For Next Gen EU, are you talking about the common borrowing or the recovery from the pandemic or both? What about that stands out to you?
It's both. I mean, one, it is, you know, some of it, frankly, seemed less about recovery from the pandemic and more the old saying of don't let a good crisis go to waste and to do things that you wanted to do anyway, like investments in infrastructure and the like. And yes, that euro area debt has gone from, you know, basically about 0% of GDP to a few percent of GDP is moving in roughly the right direction and setting a precedent that could hopefully be used and expanded on in the future.
Jeremy, what do you think? Is Europe meeting the moment?
So when I think about Europe's success or lack of success, particularly compared to the United States, I think of three things. The first is what Jason just went through, which is comparative productivity growth, where Europe has been disappointing, in spite of the fact that, you know, there is no inevitability, like Jason said, in Europe lagging behind the United States. And indeed, Europe was catching up with the United States until about the mid-2000s. And then it started falling back. And, you know, part of this is European growth performance, but a lot of this also has to do with the fact that U.S. Productivity growth picked up in relative terms in the early 2000s, and it did not do so in Europe. Now, even though, you know, there is no inevitability, there is a, I think, shared sense among economists that Europe's relatively weak growth performance has to do with some deep structural features of Europe that are hard to change. And so when you think about the comparison with the US, the two that come to mind first and foremost are the fact that we lack the kind of federal centralized decision-making on economic policy that the U.S. has. So, you know, whenever we think that something might be a good idea, usually a member state disagrees. So this makes our policymaking and reform efforts that affect the EU as a whole very sluggish. And then the other suspect is that we may have a different set of social preferences when it comes to areas where there are potentially trade-offs between growth and inequality, growth and social safety, and so forth. And, you know, as a result, as you know, on broader indices of welfare, human development, and so forth, we tend to be doing at least as well as the United States. So maybe it is about deep choices And in that sense, maybe we shouldn't be too concerned about growing a little more slowly than the US. The reason I don't completely agree with this view is because we have some member states of the EU that actually are up there with the US on productivity growth, particularly Sweden and Denmark. And they do have completely different models of the role of the state, which reflect European preferences. So we can actually do better, I think. It's just very difficult to get the cohesion, the internal coherence of policies to do that. The Draghi report tried to achieve that, and I think the record of its implementation is mixed at best so far. So that's, you know, by far the most important dimension. Now, very recently, because, you know, we are having this conversation in August of 2025, not in August of 2024, there is a need to answer this question in light of what has happened in the US in the last 6 months. And not just in the US, but, you know, more globally, we have a trend towards economic nationalism, a breakdown of multilateral rules, which is something that's important for Europe, both internally and in its relation with the rest of the world. And of course, a much bigger premium on military strength than was the case in the post-Cold War period on average, with, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saber rattling by China and so forth. And so this environment is, of course, not good for the EU, which is almost defined by not being a military power. And, you know, what it turns out is that we thought that, in a sense, military choices and economic choices could be decoupled, and they were successfully decoupled, and we could feel good about being an economic superpower without being a military one. But our dealings with the Trump administration have illustrated that, you know, at least with Putin being at the doorsteps of the EU, this is no longer the case. So our military weakness is clearly something that has undermined our negotiating position on things like tariffs with the US. So in a world where military strength just becomes more important for everything, we have diminished as a continent or as an economic area. And then the final of the 3 points I wanted to mention is, you know, there is maybe a silver lining to all of this, which has to do with our relationship with the rest of the world, meaning the world that's not either China and its satellites or the United States as it is currently. And so the US has managed to alienate a whole lot of countries out there, you know, most recently India, traditionally an ally of the US with its 50% tariffs. And so, you know, in a world where the EU is kind of the last remaining economic superpower that's still plays by the rules, this could potentially increase our influence, our standing, and also potentially our opportunities for development and growth and trade with something like 85% of the world's population. And that's not a bad situation to be in.
Now, we're going to have the Bruegel annual meetings coming up. German, can you tell us what the theme is and how it... We'll talk about how Europe is positioning itself in the middle of all those things you just mentioned.
So the 2025 annual meeting coincides with the 20th anniversary of Bruegel. Bruegel was founded as this sort of independent think tank focused on economic policy, trying to do things rigorously, a bit copying successful US think tanks like the Peterson Institute for International Economics or the Brookings Institution. We have had a good run. And so the idea of this annual meetings is sort of to look forward by about the same horizon. It's sort of a historical reflection, if you wish. So the opening session is going to be about such a historical reflection. We're going to have Mario Monti there, who was the founding chairman of Bruegel and gives a historical perspective. And we're going to have some much, much younger folks there that help us debate this. So this is the broad theme. But of course, we're going to have to deal with the fact that our immediate impressions are very much driven by what happened the last 6 months, not the last 20 years. And so a big question will be, how much of that stuff is here to stay? How much of it is a structural break in international relations, in the multilateral system, in the way that the world operated since World War II, which was, you know, a really golden period for most countries? And then what does this imply for Europe?
Meetings are going to be September 3rd and 4th in Brussels, and the first day will be fully live streamed. So if you're interested, sign up or follow along. The big story between the EU and the US in August has been the trade negotiation that took place over the summer, where Donald Trump threatened all kinds of tariffs. We had a number of pushing forward moments of aggression and then sort of stepping backwards. And ultimately, we had a kind of a deal, although it is still evolving and the details are taking shape. Jason, in your recent FT interview, you argue that the concessions that Europe gave in terms of providing preferential trade treatment to the US will actually help Europe and hurt the US in the long run, and that these trade deals do not help the US, even though they're being cited as a victory. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So first of all, let me just say two things. One is, if I were in Europe, I'd be really mad at the United States and how it handled this. I'm really mad at the United States as an American, and how it handled it and how it affects me and how it affects the rest of the world. The second thing I want to say is that Europe is well within its rights to do whatever it thinks is best for itself, including retaliation of whatever form. So I'm not saying do that or don't do that, but I'll give my economic perspective. I think the game that was being played was roughly that the United States would have whatever tariffs Europe had plus 15. And I think Donald Trump was credible in making that threat, notwithstanding this view that he always chickens out. I think once it became a bilateral negotiation, that was something the United States could actually do. And so if you're sitting in Europe and you're in a negotiation and you get to pick your tariff rate and then the United States will be whatever that is plus 15, well, the right rate to pick is zero. And you're hurt by the constraint it places on your exports to the United States, but you're not compounding the injury by adopting the same type of mercantilist misleading thinking that led the United States into it in the first place. And the problem with the way we talk about trade is it makes it sound like it's zero sum and concessions and things like that. But many times concessions are actually better for the country doing the conceding because they're getting rid of some self-harm than they are, for the other country. So given the United States strategy, I think Europe did roughly the best it could do for itself. In absolute terms, how will all of this affect Europe? Well, comparative tariff rates are going to matter quite a lot. If the United States raises tariffs on all countries in the world, you're going to have an advantage if you're towards the lower end of those tariffs rather than towards the upper end of those tariffs. So there'll be some trade destruction, but there'll also be some trade diversion, and Europe will benefit from that. And some of the macro models have even shown a small positive for European growth. Even if it's a negative, it would have been a much worse negative, in my view, if Europe had followed the Canadian or Indian path and tried to retaliate against the United States. So they salvaged, what best they could from the bad situation that President Trump created.
Chairman, what do you think?
I almost agree with Jason, but not quite. So I think Jason is being too generous to Europe and particularly to the European Commission in interpreting this outcome. So I think Europe could have done better through one of two strategies. The first relates to what Jason said at the beginning, which is that the administration had gotten it in its head that it wanted an asymmetric outcome with, a 15% spread, so to speak, between the two tariffs. Now, I do agree that this is the state of affairs, or was the state of affairs, by July of this year. But I think that, at the beginning of this process, in April, what the administration had gotten into its head was that it wanted some degree of asymmetry, but not a particular number. And the EU did not completely understand this. So commission negotiators at that time were talking about, what does the US want? Does it want tariffs for revenue or does it want tariffs for import protection and to encourage investments in the US? It wanted both of these, but it importantly wanted this third motive, which is tariffs as a way of offsetting a perceived and wrong-headed view that Europe, as well as other allies, such as Japan, as well as much of the rest of the world, even if they're not allies, were somehow benefiting from global services. You know, military infrastructure in the case of the EU, the use of the US dollar in international transactions, the use of bonds as a safe asset. So a lot of this is true, but in important ways, the US is already receiving a return on providing these global assets. That is the point which the Trump administration disagreed with. And so they did indeed want an asymmetric outcome, but not necessarily the 15%. And I think that the point where we landed basically reflects a sense of how much the EU was willing to fight. And so if from the very beginning, you do not show any willingness to fight, to the point that you react to the pause in reciprocal tariffs that the US decided, that Trump announced in early April in response to the bond market turmoil, but not just, you know, not reciprocating on the reciprocal tariffs, but by suspending retaliation on the tariffs that remained in place, aluminum and steel, then I think you're signaling that you're not willing to fight very much. You're going to be taken less seriously. So I do think that the EU could have taken a tougher position and landed in an area which was not very different from where it landed now, but perhaps somewhat more favorable for its exporters. The other choice that the EU could have had, and which Jason very strongly discourages us from, is to indeed mount a strong retaliation, possibly in conjunction with the many, many other countries that were being hurt by US policy. And so clearly, if you think about how markets in the US reacted in April, if the EU had been able to muster a large response that included not just itself, but a large section of the developing world, Asia, and so forth, it possibly could have inflicted significantly larger economic and political damage on the EU than itself it would have had to accept through such a strategy. Particularly, I think this is true on the political front, right? Because the trade war is clearly something that Trump owns. And, you know, I believe that the US public would publish him, had published him more for the trade war going awry and leading to a very substantial downturn in the US, then the European electorate would have published our politicians for their response. And so that is something that I think could have worked in an economic sense, of course, at the cost of a possible recession in the EU and the US, but, you know, with a potentially game-changing consequence as far as the outcome of the U.S. midterms is concerned. And so we didn't want to do this. And the reason why we didn't want to do this is because the Trump administration controls us militarily. And that's the link that I was speaking about before. So I think on its own merits, we probably should have engaged in a trade war with the United States. But clearly, our dependence goes beyond trade. And this is why we didn't do it. And we were probably right not to do it.
German, you made two different arguments there. One is you are much closer to it than I am. And it's basically if you had handled the negotiations differently within sort of the same paradigm, you could have gotten something better. Yeah. The only thing I'd say is anytime you look at a compromise, people on the outside can always say that. They might always be true in that there was some path that was a little bit better. But I don't view that as a profoundly important point. But again, I'm further away from it than you. The second one I agree with, which is that if Europe had gotten together with other countries, the leverage then would have been reversed. And part of how all the global trade has played out is the United States never tried to do a Mar-a-Lago Accord where it brought all the countries together to Mar-a-Lago to negotiate one deal. And other countries didn't get together and form common retaliation. And the real, you know, for me, the real turning point was in the very beginning when the United States announced an identical policy on Canada and Mexico. The three are in a very close trade agreement, and Canada and Mexico went their own separate ways, with Mexico trying to cut a separate and better deal. And so I agree that if you had a different paradigm of global, you could have had a different outcome. One of the constraints to that is U.S. military power. Another constraint, though, is just the simple free rider problem that every country in the coalition could have cut a better deal by leaving the coalition. And it's very, very hard to keep those coalitions together, even if it weren't for the military side of it.
Fair point. Yeah.
Jason, I wanted to ask you if you thought this has been a little bit of a flip of how we've been historically, where the U.S. has historically been a very open economy and has tried to keep trade flowing even when other countries tightened up, whereas the EU has historically been more closed and also very rules-based and rule-bound. And now maybe are we seeing a situation where the EU is becoming a little more open and a little more flexible in the face of what the U.S. has done?
I mean, neither side has ever been pure. There's all sorts of places where they distort all sorts of trade. But I do think the United States has been reasonably open to trade, very, very open in terms of finance. And as Jeremy said, and I strongly agree with him and strongly disagree with the Trump administration, the United States has benefited enormously from that. I mean, it wasn't just we're sacrificing at the expense of ourselves to help the rest of the world because we're sort of noble and generous and whatever else. We were creating a system in which I do think it helped other countries prosper and it helped the United States prosper. And that's why, you know, turning on that system, being one of the, you know, the richest large country in the world and somehow being so aggrieved about everyone taking advantage of us. You know, in the first Trump administration, they labeled Vietnam a currency manipulator. First of all, I thought there was no merit to that label. But regardless, you know, a big, great country thinking that the key to its economic success is the policies of a much smaller country on the other side of the world is just, I don't think, the way a country should behave. But back to Europe, on the trade side, the IMF has emphasized that the trade barriers within Europe remain very large. That, to me, is very important. If you look at something like AI and digital platforms, they require scale to be successful. The United States and China have mustered that scale because there's not really a digital market, single market. There's not really a single capital market. There's not extensive European venture capital. You know, all of these things, I think, are even more costly with the types of technology and innovation we have today. And so, you know, the more important trade conversation in Europe, I think, is less about these external barriers, but the much, much more consequential and much more, in theory, entirely under Europe's control, you know, effectively internal trade barriers between the 27 countries in the European Union itself.
Thanks for that. In the second half of the podcast, I'd very much like to come back to this concept of European fragmentation, European market characteristics, and talk about how the European economy can hold its own in all of this. German, in your opening remarks, you pointed out that Denmark and Sweden have shown that growth is possible with a European social model with high taxes and strong health care and good child care and big proportion of women in the workplace. But those countries notably also do not have European capital market characteristics. They're much more involved in capital markets. They've got much bigger participation in the retail sector and the pension sector in market-based things than a lot of their peers. So how do you see Europe trying to build on that, given the resistance in so many countries to turning to private markets on a big scale?
Yes, so I agree with both things that you say. So clearly, capital markets in Sweden and Denmark have something to do with high rates of innovation in those countries and growth. They are very difficult to create. So, I mean, very broadly, I think one can classify what Europe can do to help itself into two big brackets. One is single market, where we have both big unfinished projects and we have a, you know, pervasive sense of barriers to trade, and in particular in areas like services, which simply have not been properly being addressed. So it's not just a matter of enforcement of existing rules, which is what the last few commissions have emphasized. It's about the rules themselves. There's a very nice paper out there published in July by my colleagues, Niklas Poitier and Hul Dorm, that dissect this and also criticize a little bit the new commission strategy on the single market. And then the other thing is that there are indeed probably some, let's call them transformational reforms, that could be done at the national level and have to be done at the national level because the EU does not have competence in these areas, which could be game changers if just a few large countries did them, right? So we have had a few small countries do them, and we need a few large countries to do them. And so the two main ones are deepening capital markets, probably something that requires pension reform. So a fully funded pension system where you have large savings looking for investments, and that provides a demand-side impetus, if you like, to the capital market. And then there are better ways of reconciling a labor market flexibility with social safety, and worse ways. And, you know, for a long time, we have seen the Scandinavians as a good model. It's been hard to transfer. I don't know enough about this area of whether it would be technically very easy or more difficult to transfer, whether these things are somehow specific to small countries, but I suspect there's still a lot we can learn from these countries. Incidentally, one of the very first papers that Bruegel published 20 years ago was by André Chapier, a paper called Globalization and the European Social Model, where he argued there are four different social European models at that time, right? This is 2005. And that we do have a choice, and we have just republished that paper.
Thanks for that. Interesting thing about the Swedish model, I found out in my work at the European Central Bank last year when I was seconded over there for a few months, is that the Swedish investment system has a very different tax structure than elsewhere in Europe, certainly at the retail level. And also the pension funds invest all over the world. They don't only invest in Europe, which helps get the returns and create more capital for investing domestically, which I find interesting because of the focus on buy European in some quarters. If you guys will forgive me the leap of concepts here, Jason, I've heard people say that the huge boom in U.S. stock markets is largely due to these seven or however many large technology companies that have really taken over, and that if you take those away, U.S. performance looks a lot like Europe. Do you think that these big winners are necessary to have the kind of dynamic growth that the U.S. is used to?
So the stock market and the economy are, you know, a little bit different. The stock market's trying to predict the future of the economy. It's also trying to predict how much of the benefit of that economy will go to corporate profits and to companies. And so if you look at the stock market, yes, it is very, very skewed towards a few companies. You do see something similar in productivity growth. The Draghi report identified most of the productivity difference between the United States and Europe as coming from the tech sector. You don't, though, need to necessarily be the country with the foundational AI models. I think it's perfectly possible that those will end up being basically commodities, that if one company is 6 months ahead of another, it's not that big a deal, you know, 10 years from now, a little bit like the latest iterations of iPhones. And that it's how you adapt and use and integrate those advances into your economy, which is something that you could do whether or not you're the headquarters of the foundational model itself. And that also, by the way, says something about the stock market. You could actually have a great stock market without a great economy if there's all sorts of rent extraction. You could have the opposite. We could have tremendous productivity growth without companies really being able to monetize it and without the high stock prices. And that's a perfectly possible thing that we're going to wake up one day and it'll be like we saw with the railroads in the 19th century or the internet at the dawn of the 21st century, where there's a huge stock market collapse. You got way out over your skis, but that doesn't mean that the underlying technology itself was not really transformational. It just wasn't monetizable at the scale that the stock market thought. So just very different dynamics in the real economy and the stock market. And I pay more attention to the real economy because it's just a tiny bit less confusing to me, but it too is sometimes mystifying.
Do you think there's something to the idea that U.S. industry and productivity minus tech is fairly similar to European, or do you think there are other fundamental differences between the two economies?
There's a lot of offsetting things going different directions. So, you know, you look at European investment, it's below U.S. investment. You then drill down deeper and look at things like Europe investing more in the residential housing sector than the United States does. And when you make all those adjustments, the gap looks even larger. That's something that has to permeate through a broader set of the economy than just the tech sector. Moreover, you know, that should be solvable. Regulatory policies, tax policies, fiscal policies, you know, all of these are ways in which you can target, you know, higher investment. And, you know, you look at a country like Germany and, you know, it's had this tremendous current account surplus for decades. Another way of saying that is it's had underinvestment for decades. That current account surplus is not just the high saving, for which I think there is some defense with an aging population and preparing for the future, but it's also low investment, which I think there is less defense for, and where you're seeing the consequences in things like the auto industry. And by the way, is the auto industry an old-style manufacturing industry, or is it a cutting-edge technology industry? You know, modern EVs are as much software as hardware, and so what you're calling tech is just going to expand further and further over time.
Jeremy, let's talk about Germany. How much of this can they and should they be doing on their own? And how much do you think a country with as much weight as Germany should be doing to pull Europe together? How much of this can be done jointly versus will have to happen separately?
I would say that a lot of, you know, the question whether things are going to go right or wrong in Europe hangs on whether Germany just does well for itself or not. So I think my first concern is that Germany does well for itself. And then there's an important caveat to it, mostly in the military buildup, where I think the European dimension is really essential. So the sense in which Germany doing well for itself is critical is on structural reform and on higher domestic investment, particularly infrastructure investment, and of course climate, because it's a large economy. So if Germany addressed its pension problems, Germany's pension system is structurally unsound, right? It will increasingly run into lower and lower replacement rates. There has to be a big reform. The problem is that doing a parametric reform of the current system is easier than doing a fundamental reform that changes the character of the system from pay-as-you-go to fully funded, because if you do the latter, you need to, in effect, pay for the transition generation, for the pensions of the transition generation that did not have a chance to save. So that can cost, you know, 10-20% of GDP. Germany is not in the mood to do that. But if it did that reform, it would be really transformational for Europe. If it did certain labor market reforms, it might be transformational, essentially become more Scandinavian than it is now. And finally, there is the issue with the balance between investment spending and social spending. So, you know, the current coalition came in with the ambition to change that balance. At the same time, it did agree to a whole bunch of electoral presents in the coalition agreement that were just politically necessary to make this coalition work. And so the way the fiscal plans are designed currently is that the coalition tends to start out with a burst of spending, partly off-budget investment spending, infrastructure investment spending through a 500 billion fund that was created just before the government took over as an extra budgetary fund. You needed a constitutional majority for that. They managed to cobble that together. And of course, there is defense spending, which is credibly going to rise quite a lot. Now, the surprising thing is that Germany, at the same time, according to its medium-term fiscal structural plan that it sent to the European Commission in the second half of July, promises that it will reach the fiscal targets of the new fiscal rules, which require a lot of adjustment, even in Germany, and basically bend down its debt-to-GDP ratio by 2028, 2029. So you have a somewhat schizophrenic approach where they're trying to spend a lot, including some bad things, but mostly on the right things for the first couple of years of the coalition, and then step on the brakes in an unbelievable way. I did not anticipate this. And so, you know, there's a question of credibility of whether this is going to work. In a sense, if they really manage to pull off what they have promised, they wouldn't need to have changed the so-called debt brake. So if they're willing to really continue with high investment spending and compress non-investment spending at the same time, they could have done that within the old constitutional rule. So the whole thing doesn't completely hang together for me. What will be the outcome? Something will give. I suspect what will give is mostly the intent to compress spending. So we will have to see. But at this point, it's really too early to say whether, you know, this change in German fiscal constraints will be something transformational, whether it will be a substitute for structural reforms or a confluent or not. On the structural front, I don't see too much.
And what can this mean for the other member states? Everything we've been hearing is how Germany has to work out its own priorities and its own plans. How do they work with France, with Italy, with the other member states to come together at the EU level?
Right. So I think there are basically two areas which are very important. One has to do with the military buildup, so rearmament, where it is in the overwhelming interest of Europe to break with a long tradition of defense industrial nationalism that we have had while we were having the EU, right, which was supposed to push against any other form of industrial nationalism, but it contained a very explicit exception for anything defense related. And so as a result, defense spending in the EU has huge home bias. So Germany spends mostly on German industry, and whatever it doesn't spend on German industry, which is maybe 35 to 40%, is mostly imported from the US. France spends overwhelmingly on French industry, maybe in the order of 80% or so. And you can see that if you are going to raise defense spending in this environment by a lot, you are mainly going to make defense incumbents in your own countries very rich. But what you want is more flexibility in supply. You want to encourage entry. You want to encourage competition across European borders. And so France and Germany have a real responsibility of making this happen. They are the most ardent defense nationalists that we have in Europe. And so without them changing their ways, we're not going to make any progress. Ideally, I would like the UK to be part of the club of creating a single market for defense industry in Europe as well. So this is one important dimension. The other really important dimension is energy. So on the energy market, there are very, very large efficiency gains from pooling European electricity markets, coordinating investment in renewable energy sources or in energy sources more broadly, including nuclear across Europe, basically to exploit gains from trade in energy and the diversity of conditions for energy production across Europe. This comes with a trade-off. So this is maybe the one area where, by the way, the Swedes are not the saints that they might appear to be in all other respects, because they resist this because they have relatively low energy prices. They want to shelter themselves. And this type of argument is true for, you know, several other countries. And in the case of Germany, there is a sense that the survival of German industry rides on keeping energy prices low or lowering them, if necessary, with subsidized energy prices, electricity prices for industry. And so if you are sort of in that kind of scheme, that is flatly inconsistent with having a unified electricity market. And I'm afraid the new government is pushing in that direction and has persuaded the European Commission to accept a much diluted state aid regime that would bless those types of schemes if they are combined with climate-related investments. But, you know, just making them combined with climate-related investment doesn't make them good. I mean, we will have to accept that some energy-intensive status of production move within Europe and possibly outside Europe in order to reduce overall energy demand in a continent that is structurally energy poor because we lack not only fossil fuels, but we also lack very ample renewable endowments, particularly solar. So these are all areas where we need France and Germany, but France and Germany will vacillate because they are confronted by, you know, long-standing traditions and special interests, both in the sense that they're particular lobbies, but also in the sense that German and French interests are special relative to the European interest. And, you know, for France, that includes defense industrial nationalism. And for both countries, it includes a tendency to want to shelter there and close off their energy markets. And so this is the tragedy of Europe. I mean, this is the reason why reforms are not happening to the degree they should, because we do have this big collective action problem in Europe, and the EU can only overcome that to some degree.
Our colleague Georg Zachmann has written some great Bruegel papers with colleagues on the benefits of more togetherness in energy and a single energy grid, and I encourage listeners with an interest in that to go seek those out. I'm struck that this is the first time climate has come up in our conversation. And my question to both of you would be, what are the prospects for combating climate change, particularly given the U.S. withdrawal from some of the international agreements to do that? And what can we look forward to?
Yeah, so in the United States, we haven't just withdrawn from the Paris Agreement, but also the Trump administration repealed almost all of the energy subsidies that had been passed by the Biden administration. And so we're now going to be back on a projected emissions path that looks an awful lot like it did before the Biden administration passed its legislation. I wonder if there's a little bit of a lesson there. There had been this global fear that if you put a price on carbon, it can end up getting repealed. And that's something we saw happen in Australia and Canada. And so the United States was motivated in part by saying, oh, once you're giving subsidies, you're going to create a set of vested interests, including in states that typically vote for Republicans like Texas. And so it will be more politically resilient than a price on carbon. But this policy lasted 3 years before it was repealed. And then I look at Europe. Europe put in a price on carbon. It started very, very low, and then it's crept up over time and hasn't been repealed. And so, you know, a bit of the new idea that you need to subsidize rather than price as a political strategy, I think, has taken somewhat of a blow. Moreover, a lot of other countries can't afford the magnitude of subsidies that the United States put into this. I'm not sure the United States could afford that magnitude of subsidies either. The climate issue also really interacts a lot with another issue we haven't talked about that much, which is China. And, you know, China is just so good and so cheap at making all of this stuff. Some of that is subsidies, but an awful lot of it is not. It's just pure scale and efficiency. A lot of their subsidies themselves were never about picking winners and losers, but were about creating an incredibly competitive environment where, you know, hundreds of EV companies competed with each other and only one of them, you know, became BYD. So I sometimes think people look at China and say, we want an industrial strategy, we're going to pick a winner, when their strategy was the exact opposite of that. And it certainly wasn't, let's have a car company in every place. China raises important national security and dependence issues around all of this because of its behavior. But I think it's possible that the track Europe might be on, at least how I interpret it, is things like tariffs on EVs have an end game that would have more Chinese direct investment into Europe, China making more of the EVs there, just like Japan responded to trade restrictions on cars in the United States in the 1980s by making more cars in the United States. And if that happens, I think Europe will end up learning a lot more about EVs, being in a better position to be productive and innovative and competitive in the future. So I don't think pure free trade with China works, but I don't think pure decoupling with China works. And the climate and all these spaces really need to be able to, you know, learn and benefit from that trade and investment with China.
German, do you want to weigh in on the climate round?
Yeah, so we have recently published a report. It's called the Paris Report, the third Paris Report, together with a network of academics, the Center for Economic Policy Research, which is now based in Paris and used to be based in London. So it's a collection of the best European academics and beyond that addresses this question of how one can keep international climate and also nature action going without the United States. I must say the premise of this whole report is that the US is just not there anymore as a partner. But the premise is not that the US will actively obstruct. And so I'm increasingly concerned about whether, you know, even our assumption that the US will just drop out is too optimistic. So we have had some recent news on, for example, potentially taxing emissions related to international shipping, which have been very aggressively responded to by the US. So I'm not so sure. But the basic idea here is that we can try and export some carbon pricing by, in a sense, expanding the idea of a club of countries that pursue roughly equivalent carbon pricing strategies and then are not subjecting each other to what is called carbon border adjustments, which is a import tax that the EU will start applying based on whether the carbon content of imports is being taxed in a similar way outside Europe as it would have been taxed inside Europe if production had been in Europe. So this is a very controversial tax to introduce, the so-called carbon border adjustment mechanism, CBAM. The idea, which by the way comes from a chapter that's written by several US academics, including a colleague of Jason at the Peterson Institute, Kim Clausing, and Catherine Wolfram from MIT. And they have this idea that we should basically do a CBAM-type arrangement at the multinational level, including as many emerging market economies as we can get. There are similar ideas on building coalitions for climate finance, for greater nature action, for attempts to pull out carbon out of the atmosphere. The basic idea underlying this report is that the rest of the world is still big enough to move forward, even without the US, if there is significant coordination, roughly. And so, you know, that is true. And as global arrangements become less plausible because of the lack of US support, but also because global arrangements inherently can only get us so far, this might be an avenue to pursue. But, you know, importantly, it's one that takes not just political will, but also money. And so, you know, while it is nice to see that the European Commission has raised in its budgetary plans for the next EU budgetary cycle, the so-called multi-year financial framework, it has raised the allocation that it wants for international action, for including aid, including climate action, it is still just not enough. So, you know, I suspect this is another area where progress will continue, but ultimately at a pace that is too slow to reach the Paris temperature targets.
Thanks for that. We've seen over the course of this conversation that the US is increasingly going its own way, and the rest of the world is having to figure out where it can work together and where countries and regional organizations need to put themselves in the best position they can regardless. Jason, does Europe have what it takes to rise to this, or do you see it just being stuck in the middle between the US and China?
I think Europe absolutely does. A large population, high levels of education, you know, starting from a very strong place, a social model that, frankly, I'm jealous of and wish the United States, we had more as many conversations in the United States about how we could have the European social model, as I think happened in Europe, about how you can have U.S. productivity. And then the last thing I'd say is much of what needs to be done is known. I mean, it's not mysterious. It's been, as long as I've been paying attention, many of the items like capital markets union have been, have been on the list. And so, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's new ideas and it's always important to have new ideas. But a lot of this is things that are on the shelf and things like the Draghi report, the Letta report, much of which were not original. We're just things that were already out there. And I don't think I'm insulting either of those authors when I say that. So I think a lot of what needs to be done is well known, and maybe now Europe will take advantage of the situation it's in and give itself some more impetus to actually doing that.
So I would agree with all this, but we really have to seize the moment. I mean, we are in a situation that is structurally getting worse in the sense that the political majorities that back coordinated European reform are shrinking. And so we may soon be in a situation where you need every party that favors strong European common action to be in a government in order to be governing at all. And then we are really in a bad spot because we then have polarization in Europe along the lines of polarization in the United States now between the MAGAs, if you like, or the European equivalent, and the rest. So we are fast getting there. You know, we may get there after the French presidential elections. Now, the German next parliamentary election is fortunately some time to go, as is the UK one. But basically, that's our horizon, you know, 2 to 4 years. And so what disappoints me a bit is that we really haven't seen the type of coordinated action that we should have seen after the Draghi report. So the Draghi report was a big moment, and it was almost universally welcomed across the spectrum in Europe. But to tell you the truth, not very much has happened. The European Commission has been playing lip service to the Draghi report. But, you know, at the end of the day, on spending, it's been pushing for a very moderately larger budget. On state aid, it's been caving to pressures by member states, which are completely contrary to the Draghi recommendations. I'm not seeing strong reform leadership by the European Commission. I'm seeing some leadership on things like disclosure requirements, bureaucratic burdens. Largely, this is a commission that seems to want to get out of everyone's way, you know, out of the way of the private sector, out of the way of the member states. It doesn't show the type of leadership that the same president, Ursula von der Leyen, was showing very successfully in her first mandate. And maybe that's because she got burned, so I'm not sure. Or because Europe has become a more contradictory place and the external environment has become more difficult. But anyway, I don't think the leadership is going to come from the Commission. And so the only place it really can come from in a way that makes a difference is France and Germany. And so we need them to really get going in the next 12 months, because that's the window we have before the French election.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Jason Furman and Jeremy Zettelmeyer on The Sound of Economics. We will have links to Jason's op-ed and some of the Bruegel papers we've mentioned and the live stream to our annual meetings attached to the bottom of this podcast. Hope you can join us. Everything is available on our website, bruegel.org, which is free to access. Thank you so much for tuning in, and see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.